One thing I can say about Maya Angelou is that your life really is an open book, isn't it? You have written so much about yourself that that almost everybody knows your exploits and things that have happened to you. What does it feel like being so open about your life? As a writer, I talked to a number of writers about that. Apparently, it does not make you feel uncomfortable.
No, since I have chosen to be an autobiographer, mainly. My works are autobiographical and poetical. And since I have made that decision to use those two media, I would be hypocritical and even worse, cowardly, not to be as open as possible. I like to think that my work is my private life, which is public. I have a private life, however, which is absolutely private. So what I do is make selection about what I will tell. I insist that in my selection, I will tell the truth. And tell it as beautifully as I know, and as honestly. I mean, you can't tell the truth lying, but maybe you can. I bet you can. But I want to tell the truth as honestly and openly as possible, and poetically as possible. I just don't think that anybody has to tell everything she or he knows.
Well, now, the first in your cycle of autobiographical books was I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and that was some years ago. Did you have any idea that you would be continuing to write about yourself over the years when you finished that book?
No way, not at all. I thought, well, when I finished, by the time I finished, I knew I loved the form, that I was going to try at least one more autobiographical book. My editor, Bob Loomis, Robert Loomis at Random House, had gotten me to write the first book by telling me it was almost impossible to write autobiography as literature. Well, my response, immediate and automatic, was, who made that rule? Says you, so what? And all those sort of silly rejoinders. But I found it is very difficult. But I found I was beguiled by it. That is really taken by the form. So I thought I'd write one more to keep pressing and see if I could write autobiography as literature. And so now I've finished five, and I'm still not convinced. I'm still trying for something, Don, with the form, to use the first person singular and mean the third person plural. That's what I'm trying for. To say, I was hot. I was sweating. I was uncomfortable. I was suffocating. And write it so that the reader says it is me. I am suffocating. I am hot. That is really to say we. This is how the human being is. It's an incredible, ambitious exploit.
Now, you have in your books so many direct quotes, stretches of dialogue. Now, you're not going around with a tape recorder, do you? Or do you have one of these magnetic memories?
I never heard it called magnetic memories, but I suppose that's what I have. I seem to have something like that. I remember everything, or I remember nothing about it. And I don't seem to have any selectivity about what I remember. I think my brain did something for itself. From the time I was 7 and a half until I was 12 and a half, I was a mute. I could speak, but I refused to speak. So I think the brain did something. I mean this. It restructured itself. As we know, we are told that a person who loses one sense has the other four senses increased. I really think not having to articulate and speak that my brain then did something else and became a very good recorder. So I remember things that are very wonderful and things that are terrible. And I forget things that are wonderful and things that are terrible. And friends or family members who participated with me in certain events will say, but you remember, you spent that weekend with that guy and you were running off to Las Vegas. I don't remember. I don't remember.
Well, that shows that the mind is selective. This autism that you had as a child, I don't think at the time you had it they called it autism, but because you yourself referred to it as being mute. But what brought you out of it?
Poetry. I loved poetry. I loved it from the time I was 7 or 8. I loved it. And I memorized. I had Edgar Allan Poe. I loved Poe. I loved Poe so much I called him Eep to myself. And I had Paul R. Dunbar and James Weldon Johnson, Langston Hughes, County Cullen. I had Shakespeare, a lot of Shakespeare. Sonnets, I don't say I understood them, but I had them. I memorized. I just put it all in the machine. And then when I was walking down the dirt roads of this little village, Hamlet, in Arkansas, I would just, it was like a computer. I could punch up something. And I would punch up maybe Rudyard Kipling and just have it recite itself to me in my brain. I've never been asked that. I never heard it called autism, but of course it was. Never before.
And the people around you were stunned. All of a sudden you began to recite the bells.
Yes, yes, yes. Melodically, too, I hope. At about 12, the woman who had started me to reading in the black school came to me, and she knew I loved poetry. And because my grandmother was a woman of some power in the town and owned so much land, people didn't usually say things to her. I mean, they lived on her land. So. But in the street, in the roads, people who were angry with my grandmother would say, right past me, they'd say, it's a shame Sister Henderson's California granddaughter done gone mental. You know, it was all that. But I carried a tablet around, and whenever anyone would ask me, how are you? I would write, fine, thank you. And so, well, this woman, Mrs. Flowers, knew I loved poetry, that I had been memorizing. And she said, you don't love poetry. And it was the cruelest thing I think she could have done, because she seemed to be taking my only friend. She said, you can't love poetry. In order to love poetry, you must speak it. You must feel it come across your tongue, through your teeth, over your lips. And I ran away from her for about 6 months. Every time she'd catch me, she'd wag her finger in my face, which is very bad form with black Americans. All black Americans. We have a phrase, don't put your finger in my face. Now, you may do many things, but don't do that. Well, she would do that, and she was a lovely lady, but she was trying to shock me. And one day I went under the house, under the valley of the store, and I tried poetry, and I had a voice. I had a voice.
So that's a wonderful story. One of the things that concerns me a little bit about autobiography, and this was certainly, you mentioned Langston Hughes a moment ago, one of the poets that you admired. Langston Hughes wrote 2 volumes of autobiography, which his biographer, Arnold Ramper, said, states are False. Langston would make up people, he would make up events, he would make up dates, he would make up quotes. And so when Ampersad began to research Hughes' life, he found that Hughes really didn't tell the truth. He amplified things to make a good story out of it. Yeah. Now, tell me your autobiographical approach. How much of this is true?
Well, mine is true. It is true that I select a dramatic incident. Now, that is true. If I want to talk about generosity, I may think of five or six events which occurred, say, in a two-year span. Now, which will highlight a focus on generosity. I will choose the one I can write best. Some might be so true, I mean, they're all true, but some would lead me into melodramatic writing, and I won't have that. Another will lead me into understatement. And I like understatement, but not to have the incident so understated that it becomes obscure. So that in the selectivity, I am a fictional writer. But the incidents are true, and the people are still around.
So you're not trying for a strict chronology of every event in all of your books?
No, I don't think anybody has to tell everything he or she knows. Just tell the truth about what you do tell.
Well, now, All of God's Children Need Traveling Shoes was your last volume of autobiography. That, I guess that came out 2 years ago. Fill me a little bit on what's... 1 year ago?
Yeah.
1 year ago. Well, fill me a little bit on what you've been... Well, actually, this... Of course, the events here took place 20 years ago. So fill me in a little bit, at least, on what you have been doing, not over the last 20 years, but in the past year or so. I assume that you have been working further on your autobiography, but just tell me about some of the things that have been happening to you since the publication of this last book.
Well, I've worked on this next book, this book, Now Sheba Sings the Song, and that was a strange kind of arrangement of thinking.
Don't worry, I was not going to let you get out without talking about that.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant I had to reorder myself because I've never collaborated. I do that. I mean, I see the focus, and I have a wonderful editor, and we're 20 years together. But it is all mine, and he gave me that clearance many years ago, 18 years ago. He said, any credit will accrue to me, and any blame will accrue to me. And I have taken that. So I've never done any collaborative work in any field, even stage plays or screenplays. But this one, I've worked very hard on this slim volume, because it was not my initial idea, and to try to either enlarge myself to include someone else's idea or narrow myself down, I don't know.
Well, now Sheba Sings the Song is an absolutely gorgeous book. The artwork, of course, predominates along with your poetry. It was Tom Feeling's artwork that led to this book. So tell me how all this came about. Tell me about Tom's idea and what happened.
All right. First, in 1963, I was living in Ghana. I received a letter from Malcolm X, who was a friend and brother to me. Malcolm wrote and said, there's a fellow coming over, a young artist, and he's very, very nice and as innocent as the first breeze of the morning. He's going to marry, and may be married by the time he gets there, but she's his wife-to-be is a young woman, equally innocent. Please take care of them. Look after them. Nurture them. Lead them in the right ways. That was 63. And here we are at 87, 24 years later, and Tom and I have a book together. I mean, it's just, we have kept our friendship. I did what I could. We were a very nice group of folks, resident in Ghana, black Americans. And we did take time, Julian Mayfield and I. We did try to support and encourage him. And so we've kept the friendship. After he came back to the U.S., he went down to the Caribbean and then to South America. And he's been drawing black women all the while. And he loves black women. And that's just so fresh, you see, because unfortunately, black women seem or appear, according to what we see as the output of that, appear to a number of people, white men, white women, black men, and even black women themselves, to be too exotic to be touched, too exotic to be loved, and even worse, too exotic to be understood. And Tom Feelings loves our lips and our hips and the poignancy and sadness of the eyes and our high behinds and long legs with high calves. He really loves that. So being a black woman possessing all of those qualities.
Well, so over the years, Tom did drawing after drawing after drawing of black women, striking black women, young, old, and
pretty and plain.
Yes, he kept these drawings, and I guess he had quite a portfolio after that.
Yes. He came down to visit me in North Carolina and brought some of the painting, some of the drawings, and said, I think there's a book in here. What do you say? And so he stayed a few days, and I put the drawings up in my library. And I looked and looked, and I would just sit there, and no one could move anything in the library for those months. And then he came down again with some more drawings. And I thought, now wouldn't it be wonderful if these women could speak? Let me be sensitive enough to hear what they would have to say. Yes. I thought it would be wonderful if those women could speak. And it would be wonderful if I was sensitive enough to hear what they would have to say. And as I looked at all those faces and sort of arabesques, if you will, the body behavior, the sassiness, and sometimes the sadness and the resolution, which is so quiet, that I have come here to stay. And you can see it in black women in the street, whether they come from the West Indies or Georgia or New York City. There's something which says, I have come here to stay. And it is, again, it is repeated in the spiritual. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's planted by the water, I shall not be moved. I mean, there is that in the black woman. And so to see Tom's work, and to see it not heavy and, oh my God, and lots of breast beating and, oh, you know, putting the hand against the top of the hand as if one has put airplane glue on it and stuck it to the forehead. None of that. That's not, black women don't do that. Very little whimpering. Almost no whining. There might be some screaming. A lot of gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands, but I thought if I could hear this one woman or these various aspects of this woman's song, wouldn't that be fine?
It is fine indeed. It's a beautiful book. The poetry is magnificent. The drawings are gorgeous. Well, how did you, by the way, just for my own information, these are drawings. How did he do these exactly? Through pencil?
I think pencil and charcoal. I mean, on these various sepia tones.
Well, Maya Angelou, you haven't lost your touch, that's for sure. And you also sing just like before. And I appreciate that you got up to the fourth floor so that we could have this time to chat. It's a wonderful experience talking to you, and I want you back. I know that we're going to be expecting a lot more from you. You're not ready to pack in and retire, so I'd like to be able to talk to you later. Thank you very, very much for coming and telling me about Now Sheba Sings the Song.
Thank you very much, Don Swain. It's so wonderful of you to be sensitive enough to understand why I couldn't go to the top floor. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate your coming. Thank you.